You're listening to Citizen Detective, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons,
DNA ID,
Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Citizen Detective is recorded live alongside real-life citizen detectives.
Welcome to another episode of Citizen Detective. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Morford. My friends call me Morph. I host several true crime podcasts, including Criminology, The Murder of My Family, Missing Persons, and Zodiac Speaking. Just a heads up, if you're joining us and you want to leave us a voicemail about tonight's case, we'd love to hear from you, and we may play it on the air. Simply head over to speakpipe.com/citizendetective to let us know what's on your mind. And with that, I'm going to turn you over to Alex.
Thank you. I'm Alex Ralph, researcher and writer for Citizen Detective and Doc Show Murder Was the Case. I'm a law grad with about 15 years of experience working in criminal law. I've done both prosecution and defense, working in homicide cases and other violent crimes. Quick reminder where you can find us every 2 weeks. We are live on YouTube, twitch.tv/citizendetective, twitter.com/citizendpod, and facebook.com/citizendetectivepodcast.
I'm Doc Murder. And I'm double tasking tonight. I'm a talking head, but I'm also running the controls, so go easy on us. This is new terrain for me. I'm a criminologist. I am an author of 7 books, done a bunch of other stuff. But I want to urge you to go to patreon.com/citizendetective and become a member of the DDA, the Digital Detective Agency. When you join the DDA, you get to stick around for the scrum with us. The scrum is where it's like our citizen detective after hours. So you want to definitely join the DDA at patreon.com/citizendetective. And we're heading back to Texas, are we not, Alex?
That is correct. We are going right near where we were before. We were in Dallas. This time we're in Fort Worth, and we'll be talking about the murder of Cheryl Lynn Tunnel Springfield. Millions of families wake up on Christmas morning to celebration, gifts, and joy, while others are not so fortunate. Some people have no one with whom to share the season, and some experience tragedies so devastating that the holidays are a yearly reminder of unfathomable pain, such as the case for the family of Cheryl Lynn Tunnel Springfield. In the early hours of December 25th, 1980, 21-year-old Cheryl was assaulted and strangled, her nude body left under the Christmas tree for her ex-husband to find. Her young son was crying in one bedroom while her roommate's child slept soundly in another. Who was the monster responsible for Cheryl's murder? Police investigated her ex-husband, and he was eventually ruled out. Another suspect was, and still is, the roommate's boyfriend, who was in and out of prison and subsequently convicted of kidnapping and murder. No arrests have been made in Cheryl's case, and it is likely the only way to find this killer is through DNA. At the funeral, her sister, Jan Webster, vowed to Cheryl that she would dedicate the rest of her life to finding the person responsible, and she keeps that promise to this day. Jan is with us tonight to share Cheryl's story, her own experiences with the investigation, and give greater insight into the man she is convinced killed her sister. Retired homicide detective Cloyd Steiger and Susanna Ryan, laboratory director of Pure Gold Forensics, are back to apply their expertise to Cheryl's case. Before we bring the panel together, let's dive into the murder of Cheryl Lynn Tunnel Springfield.
So as Alex mentioned, we recently took you to Dallas, Texas, when we covered the case of Katrina Mowry. And tonight we head 32 miles west to the neighboring city of Fort Worth. Although part of the larger Dallas-Fort Worth area, Fort Worth has an identity distinct from the bustling urban hub that is Dallas. Known for its stockyards and cattle drives, Fort Worth is nicknamed Cowtown and celebrates its cowboy heritage with everything from Old West theme ranches to the John Wayne Museum. It's home to several art museums, the Fort Worth Zoo, and stunning attractions like the Fort Worth Water Garden. So at approximately 6 a.m. on Christmas Day, Scott Springfield walked to the house on Whittier Street in South Fort Worth, where Cheryl, their son, and Scott's sister lived with two teenage girls. In his arms, he carried a big wheel for his two-year-old son, Scott Allen. Although he and Cheryl were divorced, they were determined to give Scott Allen a perfect family Christmas. A fake tree stood in the middle of the living room, in stark contrast to the rest of the unkempt home. Scott arranged with Cheryl to bring the big wheel over before Scott Allen woke up, surprising him with a gift from Santa. Now, Scott and Cheryl were on good terms, and Scott had a key to the house. He used the key, entered, and out of the corner of his eye, he saw a naked woman lying on the floor under the tree. And he knew the other girls who lived in the house were heavy partiers, and his first thought was one of them was passed out drunk. He then heard crying in Cheryl's bedroom. That's when he found Scott Allen in bed, but not Cheryl. The other roommates weren't home. He checked Cindy's bedroom and found his niece sound asleep. Realizing something was wrong, he returned to the living room. That's when he realized the girl on the floor was Cheryl. He approached her and noticed a cord around her neck. He touched the cord and realized that his mother, the mother of his son, was dead. Even in his shock and horror, Scott claims he still had the presence of mind to refrain from touching anything that would disturb the evidence. He called the police and Cheryl's family, and after police arrived, Scott did everything in his power to stay calm and comfort his son.
Cheryl Springfield was 21 at the time of her death. With long brown hair and hazel gray eyes, Cheryl was a funny, pretty, loyal, and passionate young woman. Her only sister, Jan, was 18 months older, and the girls fought like cats and dogs. Their battles were epic and constant, often over things like stealing each other's clothes. The girls were raised by their mother, Patricia Tunnell, and Pat's lifelong partner, J.C. Holmes. In high school, Cheryl was a member of the drill team, the Talonettes. It was there that she first met Scott Springfield, the man she would soon marry. The couple did not start dating until later, after seeing each other in a local bar. Cheryl was 17 at the time, and Scott was a few years older. Cheryl lived at home until she moved in with Scott. They lived together until they married. Finding out she was pregnant, Cheryl married Scott Springfield in 1977, just shy of her 18th birthday. They had their son, Scott Allen, who they called Scotty. After 3 years, the couple divorced. Scott, still quite young at the time they married, felt the pressure of being too young to raise a family. Because Cheryl was pregnant before the marriage, Scott's insurance would not cover her prenatal care or delivery, and the couple had to pay out of pocket. Starting out behind the eight ball, the young family lived from paycheck to paycheck, and the financial strain was overwhelming. Scott longed for the freedom of being single, hanging out with friends, and partying. The divorce was his idea, one he came to regret. Even after the split, Scott and Cheryl remained close. In fact, they were considering reconciliation, Scott realizing that he made a critical mistake in choosing freedom over family. After the divorce, Cheryl moved back home with her mother. At the time, Jan was in California with friends. Scott's sister Cindy was very close with Cheryl and invited her to live with her in the house on Whittier Street. Cheryl and Scotty only lived at the Whittier house for a few weeks before she was killed. The house belonged to Scott and Cindy's parents and was their childhood home. In addition to Cindy, Cheryl, and their two children, two teen girls lived at the house, 16-year-old Nancy Tucker and a 17-year-old girl named Donna. Each girl had their own room in the house, and the children slept with their mothers. Partying was a high priority, at least with Cheryl's roommates. They spent most of their time frequenting bars, drinking heavily, and getting high. Like so many young people on their first foray into independence, the girls made little effort to take care of the home, and according to some, the house was essentially trashed.
Cheryl's family always celebrated Christmas on the day of, but this year was different. For the first time, the Tunnel family decided to have their festivities on Christmas Eve so that Cheryl and Scott could give Scotty that perfect Christmas morning with mom and dad. Cheryl's mother, Pat, picked up her daughter and grandson and drove them back to her house in Crowley, Texas, for Christmas Eve. Pat wanted Cheryl and the baby to spend the night, but Cheryl was firm about returning to Fort Worth that night. They spent the evening together, and Pat drove Cheryl and Scotty back to the Whittier house at approximately 10 p.m. After Cheryl arrived home, Cindy, Nancy, and Donna left for the bars. Cheryl stayed at home with Scotty and Cindy's daughter. At around midnight, Cheryl spoke with Scott on the phone, and they finalized their plans for Christmas morning. Cheryl told Scott to come first thing in the morning so they could watch Scotty open his presents. And Scott said that he would be there at 6, and after which they ended the call. As promised, Scott headed out just before 6 and walked the 5 blocks from his home to the Whittier Street house. He arrived and entered the house where he found his crying son and Cheryl's body. The Fort Worth police have been on the case since the beginning. Homicide Detective Jeremy Roden took charge of the investigation in 2017. He took the case very seriously and always made Jan feel like he cared. Unfortunately, Roden passed away in July 2018. According to Jan, Detective Roden was an invaluable resource for the family, and his absence is felt deeply. We don't know the status of the investigation, but the case is listed on the Fort Worth Police Cold Case website.
When investigators entered the house, Cheryl was still lying on the floor near the Christmas tree and a crib. Though Scott believed he did not interfere with the crime scene, he covered the body with a blanket. Bruises and abrasions were visible on Cheryl, indicating a struggle. The cord was tied in a double knot around her neck and was cut from an iron in the house. Although we do not have access to the autopsy findings, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reported in 2017 that there was evidence that the killer sexually assaulted Cheryl. Police believe the killer brought nothing to the scene, using only what was in the house to kill the young mother. In 1980, the only forensic technologies available for identifying a suspect were pretty much blood typing and fingerprinting. Investigators lifted prints from all over the house, but there was a problem. The girls had so many visitors that any of the prints could have belonged to the killer. Police did lift one partial print from the immediate crime scene, but claimed that it's insufficient for comparison in APHIS. Physical evidence was not collected and preserved as methodically as it is today. The Star-Telegram reported that some DNA was collected from the iron cord. According to Jan, investigators told her that the sample is insufficient to submit to CODIS. Investigators questioned Cindy, Nancy, and Donna, none of whom knew anything about what happened. Afterward, the two girls were terrified to return to the house. To make things worse, press coverage brought unwanted attention to the girls, resulting in threatening phone calls to Nancy, one caller telling her she was next. Ultimately, Nancy's parents sent her to live with relatives in San Antonio. Next-door neighbors reported seeing Cheryl arguing with a man on the porch at approximately 2 a.m. on Christmas morning. Police did not include the names of the witnesses in their reports, and they did not interview them about what they saw. The Star-Telegram reported that the neighbors may have been students from the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth.
Police were unable to find anyone with a motive to kill Cheryl. The most logical suspect was, of course, Scott Springfield. Since the couple was recently divorced and Scott had access to the Whittier Street house and communicated with Cheryl in the hours prior to the attack. Moreover, Scott was the one who found Cheryl's body. But Scott was eventually eliminated as a suspect when he didn't match the physical evidence collected at the scene, and he also passed 2 polygraphs. The investigation revealed the fact that Scott and Cheryl were on excellent terms and seriously considering giving their marriage another try. At one point, Texas serial killer Henry Lee Lucas told Texas investigators that he killed Cheryl. Lucas, claiming hundreds of murders across the nation, was famous for confessing to crimes he didn't commit, and Cheryl's was one of these cases. And Lucas was eliminated after his description of the crime scene didn't match actual facts. Cindy's husband, Ricky Brothers, was investigated as well. Brothers was the father of Cindy's child, and the couple was still married but separated. Brothers was abusive, demonstrating a propensity for violence. but nothing connected Brothers to the crime, and he too was excluded as a suspect. Not long after Scott was ruled out, another stronger suspect emerged by the name of Barry Dean Kelly.
Kelly was the on-again, off-again boyfriend of Cindy Springfield. Cindy met Kelly when she was 14. Kelly was a few years older than Cindy, and he was the quintessential bad boy. He had a prior criminal history and was released from prison after serving time on burglary charges about 5 months before Cheryl's murder. After his release, Kelly wasted little time in contacting Cindy and rekindling their relationship. According to some, Cheryl and Barry never met in person. Witnesses told police that Cheryl did not approve of Barry and made her feelings known whenever she answered his phone calls to Cindy. The brief conversations between the two were, to say the least, hostile. Despite his criminal past, Cindy Springfield did not believe that Barry would kill someone. Eventually, Cindy learned what Kelly was truly capable of, but by then it was almost too late. A month after Cheryl was killed, Barry was arrested after indulging in a violent crime spree across Fort Worth. First, Kelly broke into a home in North Richland Hills, 10 miles from the Whittier Street house. There, he abducted a 21-year-old woman at knife point. He forced the woman out into the night, marching her through the neighborhood until he was startled by someone in a passing car. The young woman screamed. Kelly let her go and took off. 2 days later, Barry Kelly was arrested on kidnapping charges. During questioning, he picked up an ashtray and struck the interrogator in the head. Kelly managed to escape custody and steal a motorcycle. 2 days after that, Kelly crashed the bike and was again apprehended. He pleaded guilty to assault on a police officer and went back to prison to serve a 15-year sentence on the assault and another 10 for burglary. Kelly agreed to the plea deal in exchange for a promise that he would not be charged with the kidnapping.
Barry Kelly was paroled in 1986. He again reunited with Cindy, and the two got married in February 1987. Not long after, Cindy finally saw the darker side of Kelly. He was controlling, dominating, and violent. On one occasion, Kelly held a gun on Cindy and forcibly tattooed her hands with his initials. Cindy endured the abuse until she contracted hepatitis from her husband. For Cindy, this was the last straw and she left him. And Kelly didn't go away quietly. He abducted Cindy from a store by knife point, drove her into the woods, and brutalized her for hours before letting her go. Cindy reported the incident to police and Kelly was arrested on kidnapping charges. While he was in jail, police linked Kelly to the murder of 63-year-old Melva Teams. Teams vanished from her home in Northwest Fort Worth on October 5, 1987. The kidnapper also took cash, Melva's purse, her wedding ring, a .22-caliber handgun, and a pickup truck from the house. Crime scene investigators also recovered a semen sample from Melva's bedspread. The sample is still in evidence today. 12 days after Melva's disappearance, her body was found in a creek bed. The killer ripped fabric from Melva's shirt and used it to strangle her. The fabric was tied in a knot around Melva's neck, a double knot that was immediately familiar to investigators. The knot was identical to the one in the cord wrapped around Cheryl Springfield's neck in 1980. Further investigation uncovered the facts needed to connect Barry Kelly to Melva's murder. Kelly dated Melva's daughter earlier that year. Witnesses linked Kelly to the stolen pickup truck. Although in 1987 DNA testing was in its infancy, the semen sample was sent for testing, and it produced a match between it and Kelly.
Barry Dean Kelly was arrested and charged for the kidnapping and murder of Melva Teams. He was tried, convicted, and sentenced to life in 1988. Police thought Kelly was a solid suspect in Cheryl's case. In 2017, Kelly contacted Detective Roden, hinting to him that he had information about the crime. Roden visited him in prison only to discover that Kelly was toying with him. He wanted favors in exchange for information, and police were unwilling to play his game. 42 years later, Kelly remains in prison. DNA may be the only thing that connects him to Cheryl's murder. If law enforcement has uncovered anything through advanced DNA testing, they have not disclosed this information. Without physical evidence, Fort Worth police are hamstrung, having no direct evidence linking Kelly to Cheryl's death. The holiday season is difficult for Jan. She's the only one left to carry the torch for Cheryl. Each year, Jan pushes through Christmas, mostly for the children and the grandchildren. She admits that she never gave herself the opportunity to grieve Cheryl's death. Instead, Jan remained focused on the mission, holding fast to her promise to see her little sister's killer brought to justice. Jan's biggest regret is that she and Cheryl were never able to grow beyond the sibling rivalry of their youth. Their sisterhood was frozen in time, a time when their relationship was fraught with petty fights and squabbles. Jan also regrets that with all of Cheryl's promise, her little sister never had the chance to make her mark on the world. Patricia Tunnell never spoke about Cheryl's murder, not even to police. Her pain was just too deep. For years, Cheryl's mother carried the burden of guilt over Cheryl's death. She believed that when she dropped Cheryl and Scotty off, she delivered her daughter straight into the hands of her killer. Pat Tunnell passed away in 2013 and will never know the comfort of finding out who took her baby girl. No one knows if Scott Allen witnessed the attack on his mother. It is worth noting that according to Jan, police never interviewed Scotty about what he saw or heard. Jan does remember Scotty mentioning once that the bad man put him into bed. Scotty is married now with children of his own. If he saw anything that night, his family rests easy with the knowledge that he has no memories of his mother's murder.
Time passes and Jan grows older. She realizes time may be running out. And her hope is that after she's gone, the online community and podcasts like Citizen Detective will continue in her stead, immortalizing her sister in cyberspace, eventually bringing resolution to her case. Until then, Jan keeps to her mission, calling Fort Worth police every 30 days without fail, hoping to hear one thing, that they finally have the identity of the man who murdered her little sister. Information about the murder of Cheryl Tunnell Springfield can be submitted to the Fort Worth Police Department's Cold Case Unit, and you can reach Detective Lee Wagner at 817-392-4307 or Detective John Galloway at 817-392-4336 and finally Detective Jeff Bennett at 817-392-4308. And you can also email the unit at coldcase@fortworth.com. So with that out of the way, let's turn it over to the doc and see what his interpretation is of this crime.
So hope I did okay with the switching, everyone. I've been really on my toes, but I didn't catch myself making any mistakes. Now I've got to switch over from technician into analyst. This is a horrible crime. I don't need to tell you that, but it really strikes me that the people that found the victim or the people that were related to her or friends of her around Christmas, for it to transpire like this, it's going to come up every single Christmas. That's a terrible thing. It's not exactly clear whether the victim was placed under the Christmas tree or not, or whether she was just near the tree. Apparently, the living room was very small, and that would really affect my analysis. I'd like to see crime scene photos. One would think that if there was an intent to place the victim under the tree, that the killer would have made sure that it looked intentional, because what is the point of posing someone if the person looking at the crime scene can't tell that the person's been posed? I mean, another option is that the person that found the body moved the body out from under the tree. So I guess we'll never know much about that. If that is the case, though, that the victim was posed under the tree, I like the suspect for this, Barry Dean. I mean, we have other instances where he's making these expressions associated with homicide. There is the tattooing on the hand of his ex-wife. There is playing games with the police. And so this is exactly the type of behavior you would expect from someone who leaves a body under a Christmas tree. It's a kind of message. He's saying something about himself. He's saying something about the victim. And he's certainly saying something to and about the people that are finding it. And so the tattoo, toying with the police, that would be consistent with that. Also, if you look at this man's past, he's impulsive. I mean, it really takes someone to hit an officer with an ashtray knowing that they're going to get caught. It's like he can't control his behavior. We know he breaks into other houses, all kinds of assault going on. So this would line up with the kind of impulsivity that we see in the offender. As I think might have been noted, whoever the killer was in this case didn't really bring anything to the crime scene to commit the crime. The weapon used was cut from an iron. So I think so that lines up too. And I think another part that is important is the fact that the victim was seen talking to a man outside at 2 a.m. I think it was around 2 a.m. It was after midnight at least. Now, if a stranger had come to the house at like the early wee hours of the morning on Christmas, I don't expect a woman who is there basically by herself. I mean, there was children, but she has to defend herself and the children and the home by herself. I don't think she's going to answer the door and debate with a man who's there. If he's knocking on the door late at night, she doesn't know who it is, or she's certainly not going to do this at any length, and not to the extent where people are going to notice either. So to me, it makes sense that she may not have known him to look at, but as soon as he introduced himself, she knew that this was someone who either knew her roommates or someone orbiting around there. And the suspect, Barry, would fall into this as also. We know he's capable of committing murder because of what he did with the old lady, and the knot is the same, and it's an improvised ligature. So I could get into saying, you know, is it sexual sadism? Is it more of an anger-based crime? But this one really, we have a great suspect in this. And unfortunately, I'm guessing that maybe the DNA isn't preserved. But my behavioral analysis, if I were to direct the police, I would say, listen, guys, this is most likely your man. The psychology is there. The past history is there. He fits in many ways. So we'll see if the others agree with me or disagree. Maybe bring them up now. I bring up Cloyd Steiger and Susanna Ryan, too.
Hey.
Hi, guys.
So what do you think? First of all, how did I do with the switching?
You seem fine. Good on my end. Yeah.
Okay, good. Keeps you on your toes.
Good.
Yeah.
I could catch him out of the corner of my eye, and yeah, looked pretty smooth.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so what do you think? I mean, because I was on my toes a bit, I couldn't remember if his full name was Barry Dean. Was there a surname in there?
Barry Dean Kelly.
Okay, Barry Dean Kelly. Yeah. I mean, I think he's the guy. It could be someone else, but if you line all those things up, I mean, a lot of sexual psychopaths are going to have those things in their background, but particularly right. The same knot being tied, the improvised ligature, and the fact that she was actually arguing at like the wee hours of the morning with this man outside her home. And I don't believe there was any signs of forced entry, at least none were mentioned. He would have reason to know that there's women at the house, maybe might have even known there was a woman there alone. So my advice would be keep on this guy if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing, I agree 100%. He looks like the best suspect. Although when I hear that the ex-husband was cleared because he didn't match the evidence, I don't know what that means. But I think really because he passed two polygraphs is ridiculous. Never, ever, ever clear somebody because they passed polygraphs. I see that all the time. It's ridiculous. I don't necessarily think he did it, but clearing people because they passed polygraphs is incompetent. It shouldn't be done.
I didn't write that very clearly. He didn't match the samples, the forensic samples, his blood type, things like that.
Well, here's the other thing, and Susanna, I'm sure we'll talk about this. If they have samples, even though they weren't CODIS quality, they could match him. They could test them against this guy's DNA and see if he matches, you know, or at least eliminate him if it's not him, you would think.
Right.
I'll leave Susanna, though, step on her toes here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would agree if there's anything that's available, which, you know, obviously this is tough because I don't have any of the reports. I just, you know, I have that little bit of information that was provided regarding, and sounds like it probably came from the sister of the victim, that there was some DNA on the iron cord, but not enough to enter into CODIS. But yeah, absolutely. If there's anything there, then that can certainly be directly compared to any reference samples. And again, you know, we talk about this a lot, but when was it last tested? Right. Is there any DNA extract remaining? So if there's, let's say it's already been swabbed and, you know, this is one of those types of samples that, you know, you could resample it. You might be able to pick up more DNA, but it's a non-porous surface. So typically we're going to be able to pick up more DNA than something like clothing or a porous surface. So I would suspect that most of the DNA has already been collected. But sometimes labs don't use all of the liquid, the DNA extract, where the, you know, it's a couple of drops of liquid basically. And if they didn't use all of that, then maybe we can go back to that extract and use the more sensitive testing kits today to see if we can get any more information or any more DNA results that, even if it's not CODIS eligible, again, could certainly be comparable.
Yeah, one-to-one. The other thing, you know, since I know we talked about this before, that for some reason they isolate one fingerprint that they lifted that wasn't usable value to the crime scene.
That's on my notes.
Yeah, I know. Get DNA off that.
Put that's it, exactly get it.
DNA out from underneath it. Yeah, the problem is these guys probably don't know about that can be done.
And, right.
And for some reason, they think the suspect left it there. Whatever reason, I don't know what's on.
Right. No. Yeah. No, I picked that up as well. But I mean, it's not foolproof. You know, if you get, might be able to get a result. But I mean, it's one of those, well, let's at least try.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the status is. And maybe one of you guys know offhand, what is the status on collecting DNA from felons in Texas? Or would this guy be sort of grandfathered in because he was in custody before that came into law?
I don't know specifically in Texas, but I'll tell you what, there's a real problem. We have a real problem with that. You know, we keep hearing about all these genealogical hits, and that's great. But some of them, we're finding out, you know what, this really should have been a CODIS hit. And it can be for just this reason, that this person was arrested and convicted at a time prior to the DNA collection laws. And so they're not necessarily going back and collecting those individuals' DNA to be put into CODIS. And Cloyd, I think you know specifically about this, some really high-profile cases.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it happens all the time. But in this case, there's probable cause. You just get a search warrant to get his DNA. I mean, this guy's got a nexus to the victim, and he has probably never been there before. She didn't really know him, so and he's murdered after that, and so it's which even though it's a 404B or prior bad acts, even though it happened after the time, that's enough to get a warrant. And the other thing, when you write your warrant, you say that the DNA will not only convict the guilty, but it'll exonerate the innocent. So it's just fact finding, you know, it's not biased one way or the other, and so just get a warrant and go do it, go get a sample.
Yeah, this guy seems to me like a very plausible suspect.
Absolutely.
But what I worry about is he some kind of red herring, because we mentioned that Cheryl didn't really know him, and if he showed up at 2 a.m and they had argued on the phone, she had never met him in person, I don't know that she would necessarily be outside talking to him. So I wonder if there's any kind of possibility that this was a jealous suitor, maybe someone that was interested in her, and she sort of said, look, I'm getting back with my husband and this isn't going to work out. You know, I would bet the money that this guy was the perp. But on the other hand, I think investigators should definitely keep their mind open to
being. Yeah, you always have to be open minded. You can't assume that this is the guy. But if that's what it shows, that's what it shows. And the other thing, as far as clearing the ex-husband, you know, if it's true, I know if it's apocryphal or true, that the little boy Scotty said the bad man put me in bed. He wouldn't say that about his dad. Right. It had to be a stranger. And they didn't even try to interview him at all and to see what he knew. I mean, that's ridiculous. Even though he's three or whatever he was, you still see he might drop some little tiny thing and that could be very crucial in the case. And you have to talk to him. You're not going to base your whole case on what he says, but you need to talk to him.
Yeah. From the sounds of it, there were a lot of people coming in and out of this house, like a party spot. And those teen girls going to bars. Who knows what amount of different people could have come through that were all, you know, also bad guys, not
right. Well, that's Kelly true. Alone. That's why finding this stuff is, if you can't directly tie it to the murder, it's going to be difficult, because so many people come and go from that house, and finding their DNA in the house doesn't necessarily mean that they had anything to do with this murder.
This is also possibly too why everything is improvised. Maybe the person who came to the house wasn't planning on committing a sexual homicide at the time, but maybe he was just thinking he was going to get laid or something, or maybe didn't even know who was home. And then knocking on the door that late, things escalate, get out of control, and you know, he lets his demon out. Although I think this is important too. I think it's a rare person that can kill and sexually assault a woman, strangle her to death with a ligature, and then will leave her, you know, what has been described as under the Christmas tree, at least near the Christmas tree, knowing that there's children in there that are going to come out. That's why I'm pretty comfortable eliminating the father, unless like he's an absolute monster and that would show up otherwise.
I don't believe it's him either, but the fact that they use the fact that he cleared past politics to clear him is something I see.
Do you think that because, I mean, if it's correct that this perpetrator put Scotty back into his bedroom, do you think that that indicates that he had been in the house before, so he knew which room was Scotty's bedroom? It sounds like a lot of people were sleeping there or living there. So how did he know which room to put this child into, if that's the case?
An excellent point.
Yeah, but it could have the markers of being a, you know, infant male child's room, you know, rocket ships on the, all that He-Man.
It sounds like they slept in the same room.
They slept in the same room with their mom. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that is interesting.
And Kelly would have known which room was Cindy's, where she slept with her daughter, because he'd been there before.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. I want you guys to look at something. Behind me here on this table, I'm making a board game. That's right. I just wrote a screenplay. I'm working on another one. I've got this show. I've got my other show, Murder Was the Case. It's like, Lee, how'd you stay so focused? Duh. Magic mind. I mean, since I've been taking this, I've just at a different level. It's just like constant winning. But the secret is magic mind. That's really it.
When you're juggling that much stuff like you are, is there anything you can't do, by the way?
Can't stop taking magic mind. Can't stop talking about it.
You need the magic mind because, you know, with everything you're doing, I have like 28 podcasts that I'm either co-producing or co-editing or co-hosting. So you need something that really keeps you fresh and on your toes and clear thinking. And that's what I get out of magic mind, is just the way that it really keeps you focused. You have a little bit with or without your coffee, however you take it, and you're good to go. And that's what I really love about it.
How are you going to get that much stuff done otherwise, right? You're going to clone yourself? Magic mind is the answer, Alex. What do you think?
Yeah. Wow. I don't know how I can follow that, but I'm still using the magic mind every day and I'm still feeling, you know, much more alert, but without the jitters. I mean, I remember in law school, I was drinking 3 triple lattes a day just to get through my coursework and work. And I tend to still fall onto those habits when I'm writing and I'm trying to take care of a farm and my partner and the house. And it just feels so awesome to be able to keep that energy all day without feeling that shakes and that feeling like you're never going to get to sleep, because I'm able to just fall asleep naturally and wake up alert and ready to go for the next day. It's great stuff.
Going to magicmind.co. No, I'm on the end there, people. It's magicmind.co/1414daysofmagic. So magicmind.co/14daysofmagic. Don't forget to use our promo code detective14. That's detective14. So you can get 20% off your first Magic Mind purchase. We should save some of this for the scrum. That's for members of the DDA. And Jan will be joining us in the scrum later too. So we'll have Jan in there, but also all 5 of us. But right now, Cloyd and Susanna, lovely having you again. Can you guys just make way for Jan, please? And we'll ask her some questions. Then we'll get to your comments after that. And then we'll go to the scrum and we'll bring everyone in the same space.
We got you, Jan?
I'm here.
Okay. It's a little dark there. There you are. There you go. Hey there. There she is.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Jen.
So thank you so much for coming, being a part of this. And if you could just, you know, give us some more about Cheryl and who she was, your relationship, your family, and what your experiences have been with the investigation over these 40-some years.
I'm trying to pick my words. First of all, I want to say something that I guess I didn't, or maybe it didn't get in there. At some point, I was told that they did talk to Scott Allen, but that he said Santa Claus did it, and it was just garbled all over.
Oh, wow. That's terrific.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we were kids. I mean, we were 21 and 22. So, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot to say. We had one of those relationships where we would fight like cats and dogs, but if it got Harry for either one of us, the other one would have been there.
I think that's a very common relationship between siblings that they'll fight like cats and dogs, but let someone else try and mess with one of them and see how quickly the other one comes to their defense.
Exactly. But it was just, it was a horrible situation. I don't even know anymore.
Right.
Like I've tried everything. I've talked to everybody. Roden, all that, I haven't got as much interaction with the new detectives as I had with the ones prior to. And I don't know what that reasoning is, but maybe they're working on something and they just haven't had time to tell me yet.
So you started this mission on the day of the funeral.
I did.
What has that been like? With the promise that you made to her, what has that been like for you? How have things changed over the years as you've gotten older? You know, what were you doing then to try to find out who did this, and what have you learned over the years?
Right after I was young, so anything that I was doing was probably not going to get anywhere. I mean, but once I started getting in things like getting my paralegal certificate and working with attorneys and dispatching for the police department, then you would get more insight into what things needed to be and what research you could do and just different ways to find things out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think at one point I was the one that pulled Perry into it. I mean, I think, I don't know if the detectives knew it or when I called him and said, hey, look, he was dating her and they just convicted him, because that was a big deal in Tarrant County back then, was the DNA conviction.
Mm, yeah, it would, because that was right in the beginning.
Right.
Of DNA. Although, you know, he still ability to use it.
Yeah, he's like, the DNA wasn't mine. I didn't do it, blah, blah, blah. And I want to say that Roden did go down there or somebody did, maybe it was Cheryl, and they did get a warrant for his DNA. That's what I was told.
Huh.
Now let me straight. That was what I was told.
Well, that if that was true and accurate, and they did get it and test it against the sample, you'd think they would make that publicly known and say, "Hey, this guy's been cleared out since his name is out there," tell your family that.
Yeah, what Roden told me was he could not be included, but he could not be excluded.
Hmm.
Interesting. I'll be really interested to see what Susanna has to say about that.
I mean, that guy, he bested, you know, he did above and beyond to try to do this. And in fact, before he passed, he even told me, I think he did it. I just can't prove it.
And I know you were sort of at each other's throats, so to speak, you and Cheryl, and maybe not communicating as closely as you might have been. At the time that she was going through this breakup and this possible rekindling of the relationship, did she confide in you at all about going back to the relationship, or if there was anyone else that was interested in her that she was interested in, any other potential people in her romantic circle?
No, and I was in California, so we weren't really chatty. I was doing my thing and she was doing hers.
Yeah. Did you ever talk to any of her close friends that were close with her there in Texas at the time?
Well, she had kind of, her friends from high school and stuff, they had all kind of lost contact. So the only people that would have known something would have been the people that were in her circle right then, which would have been Cindy or Donna or the other young lady or whoever they were hanging out with. But she wasn't in that house long enough, I don't think, to have some kind of deal where they, you know, where it was somebody she really knew. You know what I mean? I could see Barry, and this is just my opinion, which doesn't mean anything, but I could see, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, Barry coming by there after the bar is closed looking for Cindy. And, you know, Charlene telling him, you know, because she was sassy and, you know, it just escalated. Yeah. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, it's a good scenario. There's some evidence we can't discuss, but there's some behavioral evidence that would indicate that the perpetrator might have been drunk.
Oh, yeah. That's just that's just my opinion. So, I mean, it just makes sense. I'm going to come over there and I'm looking for my girlfriend and she's not there and you're here and you don't like me and you're getting lippy and, you know.
Yeah. So he's a bad guy, but he's not planning to commit a murder that night. But when the events turn a specific way, it lets that evil part out of him.
He's an ass. He's an ass. Cause I mean, when they showed her a picture of him, he's like, oh, well, I don't know her. I've never seen her. Liar? You know, I mean, he's lying. He was at the funeral. So.
Doesn't he still proclaim his innocence on the team's murder as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's like the child that's sitting there with the cookie. But no, I didn't get it out of the cookie jar. I got chocolate
all over my face, and I didn't do anything. He's got nothing to lose at this point, except having that kind of control over whatever. And it seems like Cindy at one point may think that he did it also.
Well, and to your point, he's got nothing to lose because he's in there for life without parole, right? So, but he also has, if he does. Definitely nothing to gain, because if he is linked to Cheryl's murder, then he could face the death penalty.
Right.
So that could also be why he doesn't want any part of it. That's why it would be really good to know if his DNA was actually compared to whatever they have, and if they were able to rule him out. But then again, you said that it was inconclusive.
Right. And even if, you know, they came back with the iron cord was closed. So even if they came back and told me, you know, his DNA is not on the cord, I'm not going to buy it. I mean, just because his DNA is not on the cord doesn't mean it didn't deteriorate. It doesn't mean that it wasn't destroyed. It doesn't mean anything to me, you know. But again, it's my opinion. I kind of get fired up sometimes. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
That's good.
We understand why. Yeah.
So I'm going to go talk to him, I think.
Yeah, that's what you're telling me earlier today, that you're going to go visit with him and see what he has to say.
Yeah, I'm going to take my friend with her, and we're going to go talk to him. He probably won't talk to us, but. You know, I've sent him Christmas cards. I sent him a copy of the article from Star Telegram. I sent a copy of the article to the warden, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that, you know, he knows who I am.
Oh, yeah. You told me when we were speaking that one of the ways in which he was playing with police, something he wanted in exchange was for the death penalty to be taken off the table.
And maybe a different place, you know, a different prison to be in or whatever
right.
it was that he was wanting. You know, they can't take the death penalty off the table. You know, they can't commit to something like that. So, I mean, I'm kind of on both sides of the coin. I can kind of see both sides. I can see, you know, the cop side, but then I can see if you get him into trial, you know, what's going to happen if, you know, some of these other things happen, that the defense attorney's just going to, you know, walk it right through.
Right. Right. And you've worked for defense attorneys long enough that you can see through their eyes and how they would attack a case.
Yeah, but I'm not an attorney. And I mean, I don't know much, but, you know, and that's
paralegals know a lot more than you give yourself credit for.
I just don't know what you know, I know they've got a whole lot of cases and I know there's a lot of cold cases. But, you know, some of these ones that are so old, we're all getting older. I'm 65 years old and there's nobody left. So,
right. You
know, you need or somebody needs to do something and get on the ball about these older cases and either close them because you ain't got squat or test it and find out what the hell's going on. You know, and I know they're overworked and underpaid and they don't have anything, but there's all kinds of resources out there that they could try to get that would help them with it if they would just open their minds up, or whoever the powers that be are would, you know, just, I don't know.
Yeah. Like outside funding. I mean, this is, I told you that, you know, this is something that comes up in just about every case we cover, is efforts to try to either crowdsource or private pay for some of this testing. And there are agencies and states that are like, no, we absolutely cannot.
Oh, I offered to pay for it. And they're like, no. And I understand where it could jeopardize everything. But, you know, even at the point, I'm at the point in my life, if they did it and they proved without a doubt that it was him, I don't care if he's prosecuted or not. He's not going anywhere. He's going to stay there. He's going to die there. You know, it's not hurting anybody.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I was just going to say, it sounds like you would just be happy to have an answer finally.
Exactly. I mean, and fulfilling the promise.
Yeah. Rebecca Casella is one of our regular viewers. She says she's very sorry for you and your family, and she hopes that justice is forthcoming, and so do we.
Aw. Yeah. I do, too. I'm tired. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm tired. I don't know what else to do. You know, I've tried. I don't know where else to go or what else to do other than just keep doing these podcasts and keep bringing the case up. You know, they saw Carl Walker's, but what's
does that give you hope?
Huh? No.
Does it give you hope seeing that these old cases are being solved? It doesn't make you hopeful?
No, I don't know why it doesn't, but it just doesn't. But, you know, even at the end of the day, if it's solved, she's still dead.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's part of the problem. I mean, as if they solve it and then I find out, then I've got to accept the fact that she's really gone. And it's not just like a case file or something that I just, you know, mess with.
Mm.
Right.
Now, I'm curious, too, just how, you know, her son was so young when this happened. How has he, you know, grown up not having that role model, that important person in his life?
I'm going to be honest with you. He had Scott, and Scott married a wonderful woman that is, you know, she's amazing. And, you know, Scott Allen has some issues, and him and I don't communicate. We just don't agree on much of anything. And, you know, he's just, I don't know if his issues are because his mother was murdered or his issues are because they're just his issues. But Scott raised him, and his wife raised him. They've been together over 30 years. Good people. And she's my friend, so.
Very sad situation.
Thanks for joining us, Jan. We're just going to go to a break, and then we're going to go to some comments. Will you stick around and jump back on with us later, and you can talk to Susanna and Cloyd in the scrum?
Yeah, if you can stand this voice.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. It's a great voice. It's a
squeaky toy.
Okay. So we'll see you in a few minutes. Just stick around.
If you're listening to this episode of Citizen Detective, we know you'll want to hear what happened in the Scrum, the Citizen Detective after show, in which we continue discussing this case with our guest. You'll be interested to hear what didn't make it into the regular episode. Here's a preview.
I'm fairly sure he's a psychopath. I mean, there's a lot of indicators. There's the ability to do reactive violence, but also instrumental violence. So he can plan it premeditated, or he can go off. He's impulsive. As diverse victims.
It's revenge, it's anger motivated. Somebody pisses him off. So I would, me, and please you guys correct me if I'm wrong, those are the types of cases I'd be looking at.
Yeah, I hope he hears this and he can hear every one of us talking about what an idiot he is.
To listen to full episodes of The Scrum and get ad-free episodes of Citizen Detective as well as other benefits, you need to become a Patreon supporter of the show. Visit patreon.com/citizendetective right now to become part of our digital detective agency.
Bring Ashley up here to talk about Patreon.
Hello, everyone. I would first like to thank our newest members, Missy D, Justin W, Jill I, Lori O, and Steve D. Here are the basics if you're considering joining these lovely people. The Nancy Drew tier gives you ad-free episodes, bonus content, and the Scrum. The Scrum is an after-hours for our hosts and guests where the conversation continues. The Columbo tier contains the perks of the first, plus a guarantee that at least one of your comments or voicemails will be heard on the show. The Poirot tier contains the perks of the first and second, plus access to a quarterly private session where members will join and interact with one or more hosts to discuss cases explored on the show. Think of it as a masterclass where you and the host dig even deeper into your pet case. The fourth and final is Sherlock Holmes, which contains all perks so far, plus a VIP pass to any special in-person event where you can meet and hang with the hosts of Citizen Detective. As we grow, there will be coming your way. Watch this space. Head on over to www.patreon.com/citizendetective. Citizen Detective streams every 2 weeks on YouTube, at Citizen Depod on Twitter, at Citizen Detective Podcast on Facebook, and twitch.tv/citizendetective. I wish all of you a very Merry Christmas. Now back to the show.
Merry Christmas to you too, Ashley. Probably be the last time I see you before then. We're really glad to have you this year. You do a great job. Let's get everyone back up here. Yeah, before we forget, because I almost did, good job, Ashley. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Alex, Morph, and to everyone watching that celebrates or whatever you celebrate. You know, the older I get and the more time I spend around the crime thing, it just makes more and more sense in a way that we try and get our little pleasures where we can, like little things like Christmas, being together with people, and just generally try and keep that spirit going all year. Like try to be nicer to people and try to genuinely care, you know. I heard those words a lot when I was younger, but it's like every year it moves on. I realize how important it is that the older I get.
Especially someone for like Jan, her situation, you know, holidays have a different meaning now that brings up this terrible thing that happened in her life. So, you know, I think everyone would definitely take that kind of stuff to heart and celebrate the holidays and be kind to one another.
Yeah, don't take it for granted, because you don't know who might not be there next Christmas.
Yeah,
exactly.
Love feels good. So with that, should we give some love to the comments? Let's see. Want to read these out, guys? I'll man the controls.
Sure. I'll take the first one. This is from Ms. Lee or Leah. I'm in the true crime YouTube community and will share your link and channel out to others. More people need to be aware of you. Well, thank you so much for doing that. And that's really kind of you to say. We really appreciate it.
Help spread the word on these cases. It means a lot. And there's families out there that are looking for answers. So anyone that can share this show and these cases, we appreciate it.
We got another one from More Love. Told you love is Lee, good. Isn't that nice?
Yeah. She just wanted to drop in and share some love. You guys are great. Yeah. Thank you.
We're talking about the love.
And Karen Boswell Traeger says that, you know, she was 21 years old. Very sad. I agree. You know, young son, probably excited, you know, about the future and seeing her son grow up. And then something like this happens. Awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we have the luxury of getting older and learning, like I was just talking about, you know, moving into middle age. And, yeah, you know, the faith, peace on earth, goodwill to all men really matters. And, you know, it is a privilege to be able to get to that wisdom, you know. And that's the sad part about it, too. There's so much growth that we have to do. Here's a more technical one from Rebecca Casella.
Rebecca wants to know, what was she wearing when she was found? I asked because some DNA may be present on her nightclothes. We do not have access to that information. We don't have the reports or anything. And what is out in the public has kept it pretty minimal to her nude body was found. I read that when Henry Lee Lucas tried confessing, he said she was wearing a black lace nightie, which was one of the reasons they knew that he was just giving them false information. But other than that, we don't have that information.
Good question.
That's a really good point.
Susanna could maybe address in the scrum that, hey, maybe there's some touch DNA, something that MBAC could find, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, whether the degree to which the victim was dressed and the location of any clothes removed is also really important too, because what I don't have is a sense of like the dynamics of this crime, like how it played out spatially, which room it started in, you know, the point of encounter. Was the point of encounter at the door? I think it was. Did he push in? And then, you know, where is various parts of the assault committed? So that's why things like crime scene photos are really so crucial.
Yeah. And also, absolutely. Did she fight back? Did she do any damage to him? Is there anything that she may have under her fingernails, you know, without having those details and reports sort of left to guess?
Karen agrees with us. I think all of us is this our number one suspect? Well, I guess that's obvious, but is there anyone who thinks he didn't do it?
No, I don't see anything that says he didn't do it, but at the same time, I still feel like, you know, there could be someone that's, you know, he's a red herring. There could be someone else that's wants to get into her life and she's maybe rejecting him and he doesn't take it too well. Because I don't know that necessarily he shows up, she's opening that door for him because she didn't like him as it is. And she had never met him in person. So I'm a little bit skeptical of whether she would open that door for that guy.
Well,
people are agreeable, more agreeable than we think though. Right.
And young women, especially if he was like, hey, I'm here to see Cindy. She might recognize the voice. You know, let me the fuck in. No, you're not coming in here. Cindy's not home. She's got the kids in there. He pushes through the door. So the other thing I thought, if it wasn't him, is that the girls were out in a bar And granted, they didn't get home till the next morning, I believe. But maybe someone that they knew, someone else that they knew, came around after the bars closed looking for one of the other girls. Well,
there you go. And that's why I want to leave that open in my mind, because I remember, you know, in the 80s, I did some partying, and I used to party at some places where it was the party spot, and just people used to drift in and out, and didn't know who was coming, who was going, if they had any kind of criminal records. So he seems on paper like the best suspect in my mind, but I just want to leave open the possibility that someone else could have done this.
It's hard to ignore killed another woman in a home invasion, strangled her with an improvised ligature, tied the same knot.
Mm-hmm.
That's you hear me talk about signature all the time. Those are really specific signature elements.
Now, when we say tie the same knot, how in depth do they get into that? As far as it is, it the same knot? That's one thing I would have a question about.
I want to see pictures. That was a double knot.
Yeah, I mean, if it's I'll bring this up here.
Yeah,
if it's one of these, right? You got the two ends, and you just tie it around like that, and you pull it. That's everyone's going to tie that knot, right? It's how specific is the knot?
Yeah,
it really matters.
Right.
So you got plenty more comments. I think we should leave some of them for the scrum. I'll put one more of these up. It's from Karen again. And she said, I like this idea. We'll see what Cloyd thinks about this.
So Karen says, how about we plant somebody in prison with him and see what he says? That's been used before.
I think he has a need to boast when I talked about
the
communicative elements of his character. What I would term technically expressive transformative. If anyone wants to read my dissertation online, I kill, therefore I am. That's why I thought he might have placed her under the Christmas tree, because he's doing things like tattooing his name on someone's hand.
Then again,
mouth to the police.
Would he be bragging for prison cred, saying, hey, I'm a badass, don't mess with me because I killed this girl, and I'll kill you too. So that you have to also take that with a grain of salt.
I think, I think it'd be more personal reasons. Like, he probably is proud of it. He seems psychopathic. They have that sort of grandiosity, you know, probably sees these as an achievement. Might be able to even reliving them sexually. It's not nice to think about, but that's what these people are like. And we know that they do boast to people in prison. They get caught a lot with that. And I think this person would be a perfect candidate for that. Maybe he thinks he's impressing the person he's confessing to, right? It feels good to go through it again. Did you know I got away with this? That's how smart I am. I toy with the police. So I like that strategy. Good one, Karen. Okay. So let's just, let's wind it up. Shall we talk about CrimeCon? We want to tell you a little bit about CrimeCon, the biggest invention in the world of true crime, where thousands of people come together to discuss their favorite cases, rub elbows with some of the major players in the field, and interact with some of their favorite podcasters. CrimeCon's a three-day event, and the next one is less than a year away. CrimeCon 2023 will be in Orlando, Florida, at the World Center Marriott, September 22nd to September 24th. And having been to Orlando, Florida a few times, even without CrimeCon, it's a hell of a lot of fun. I like the tiki bars. I like the giant gorilla roller coasters and such that they have there. And you add CrimeCon on top of it. It's almost like, well, why wouldn't you go?
You know, judging from all the crime cons I've been to, it is a blast. There's a lot of fun things to do. Lots of people that are like-minded that aren't going to judge you. You know, if you're into true crime.
Oh, I wouldn't bet on that. Well, everyone judges me.
It's a tight community, and if you're into true crime podcasts and true crime TV shows and learning about these cases, you'll feel at home, and then you get to hang out and meet people like Nancy Grace, Paul Holes, Dr. Henry Lee, and maybe us. So definitely consider going.
Yeah, the more drinks I get bought up front, the more likely I am to be there. Just saying.
A little payola to get you to CrimeCon. So, and don't forget that you guys, listeners of Citizen Detective, can save 10% on your badges for CrimeCon 2023 with our promo code at checkout. So just go to crimecon.com and use the code Citizen Detective, all one word, no spaces. and book soon, because from what I hear, spots to Crime Con sell out really quickly. And get those tickets, because we guarantee you're going to have a really good time. And like Morph said, you might see us there.
It would be cool to do a broadcast from Crime Con.
Oh, that would be fun.
We could have people stand in front of us and give the comments instead of reading them off the
That would be very cool.
Yeah. But sadly, right now, we have to bring the live show to a close, but we are headed over to the Scrum, and we're going to go a little deeper into Cheryl's case, and we'll see our patrons there shortly. And of course, there's still time to join us tonight if you go sign up on our Patreon page right now. We're going to take a short break during the holidays, but we will see you again on January 10th when we look at the Doodler, a San Francisco serial killer who murdered at least six gay men during the mid-1970s. Until then, stay safe, please hug your loved ones closely, and have a sensational holiday season.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Yeah. Ditto.
The Citizen Detective team includes co-hosts Mike Morford, Alex Ralph, and Dr. Lee Meller, who also provides case analysis. Writing and research, Alex Ralph. Technical producer, Andrew Gray. Production assistant, Ashley Monroe. Be sure to catch new episodes of Citizen Detective every other Saturday, wherever you listen to podcasts.